So let's go back to this question of impermanence. Impermanence. Impermanence is all around us. Everything is impermanence. There isn't anything that isn't impermanent. We see the leaves falling. We see the flowers fading. Everything is impermanent. But the most concrete, the most vivid, the most powerful, the most effective, the most touching, the most concrete form in which we encounter this impermanence is death, especially the death of someone near and dear to us. Death, that is to say, the dissolution or the breakup of the physical body. Now, in Buddhism, as we all know, there are quite a number of practices which are intended to remind us of this fact of death, dissolution, breakup of the physical body. Quite a number of practices meant to remind us that inasmuch as the physical body was put together, one day it's going to be taken apart, or one day it's going to fall apart, it's just going to disintegrate. Whatever was holding it together, it's no longer going to hold it together anymore. So we've a number of practices in Buddhism to remind us of this very obvious fact, which so often, of course, we forget. We've got, for instance, the six element practice, or at least the first four stages of that six element practice. Here, as you know, we reflect that whatever there is in us of the earth element is borrowed from the earth element existing all around us in space, in the universe, and one day we've got to give it back. Similarly with the water element, similarly with the fire element, similarly with the air element, one day we're going to have to give them all back. And that process of giving back, willingly or unwillingly, is the process of dissolution, breakup of the physical body, or death. And then we have, of course, the 10 so-called corpse meditations. I don't think many people here are acquainted with these personally. When you go along to a burning ground, a cremation ground, a charnel ground, and you just see corpses in various stages of decomposition. And you reflect that as they are, so you will be one day, because you too are subject to death. And then again, there's the, let us say, relatively plain, straightforward practice of simple recollection of death. Just reminding yourself that yes, one day you will have to die, just as every other human being will have to die. So these practices all serve to remind us in one way or another, from one point of view or another, more or less effectively, that all human beings are subject to death. All human beings one day must die. Even the greatest, even the best. Even great heroes must die. Great conquerors, perhaps very noble people, great rulers, they must all die. Their power doesn't save them. Great artists, great poets must die. Their art, their poetry doesn't save them. Great thinkers must die. Sometimes these people die not just in the normal course of things. They die premature. They die unpleasant deaths. One thinks, for instance, in relatively modern times, of Keats dying of consumption at 25. One thinks of Shelley drowned at 30. One thinks in Wordsworth's phrase of mighty poets in their misery dead. One thinks of Spinoza, a great philosopher, a great thinker, again dying of consumption at the age of about 40. they all die. Sooner or later, prematurely or in the ripeness of their years, they all die. Their greatness, their political greatness, moral greatness, artistic greatness, philosophical greatness can't save them. And even the Buddha must die. The Buddha is enlightened, yes, but he's an enlightened human being. And every human being must die, because every human being was born. Everything that has a beginning must have an end. So even a Buddha must die. It seems very strange, it seems very paradoxical. It seems almost unbelievable, incredible, that a Buddha should have to die. But as I've said, an enlightened human being is an enlightened human being. And inasmuch as he is human, or to the extent that he is human, he must die.